All right, everyone. Get excited.
This is exciting.
There is going to be a wonderful episode of Non-Productive for your head coming right at your brain.
No.
In this particular episode, we've got a very exciting topic for all of you. We are going to talk about movies. Specifically, we're talking about movies where the villain is actually the hero and vice versa. All right, I feel like we need a little bit of explanation for this. First of all, who are we? I'm Frank. Matt is remote in his, I guess villain lair? We can pretty much say that by now?
My secret underground base.
All right, cool.
I was going to go with Castle in the Sky.
Oh, well, then wow. we also have AJ, who is occasionally referred to as Cappy, but very inconsistently, so I have no idea if that's his secret identity. And James and Al are also here. We may have guest stars because we forgot to lock the door. Anyways, this is the concept of the podcast. We're going to be talking about movies where what you would think of as the hero of the film is actually kind of a jerk. It's probably a bad guy, like a villain at least. Why would that be at least? And we're going to talk occasionally about movies where the villain is right. That was right the entire time. Now, you may be very slow, listening audience, so I will spell this out for you with an example. Probably one of the most famous versions of it. There's a very popular YouTube video, which we'll hopefully credit in the podcast maybe, but it's the one about the Karate Kid. I hope you all have seen the original Karate Kid movie from the 80s.
Right.
Danny LaRusso is this like...
Daniel Shan.
Yeah, well, we don't need to do voices already. God, we just start off with racism and such. I guess Mr. Miyagi was also doing a fake voice.
Technically.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
I never thought about that. That racist Pat Moriarty. Anyways, focus. So yes, the Danny LaRusso, everybody knows that he's the hero of the story, but when you think about it, he's kind of a jerk. There's a lot of instances where he instigates the fight with Johnny. Johnny Lawrence is the Karate Kid. He's the one who learned karate. He trained himself into this. There are at least a few instances in the movie where things kind of like calm down between they're teenagers, they're fighting. Things sort of calm down, and it's Danny who's picks the fight, who either turns it physical or reinstigates the fight, like the scene in the Halloween party where he sprays them with water when he's sitting in the John, or when they initially had their first fight on the beach, it's Danny who, you know, gets physical first. It's very weird, but there is like this sense of creepiness, and hopefully this podcast, a lot of these instances will immediately ring true for most of you.
It's a little weird that the movie's called The Karate Kid when all these other kids already knew karate.
Yeah,
like he goes to a martial arts tournament. Like they already know
on itself.
Like he learns their hobby just to beat them at it.
Yeah, it is a very unsettling thing. I think there's another little thing where we want to get clear is that we're going to try to avoid instances where that's intentional by the filmmaker.
Yeah.
So, for example, and we'll call out spoilers beforehand, I guess, but if we're mentioning a movie, imagine you could assume we're going to talk about it. Harry Potter is a good example. In Harry Potter, there is a character, Snape, who is painted as a villain through most of the series, and you end up realizing he has a lot of strong motivations for what he does, and it's sort of a misdirect. Any film that involves spies or misdirects or what have you, that's not what we're talking about. If it's intentional by the filmmaker, that's not what we're looking at. We're also not looking at anti-heroes, those kind of like rugged, jerky-faced guys who are just, you know, they're good guys, but they're kind of rough at the same time. Not unless they expressly do things that make them villains. And it's up to every commenter to sort of justify their case.
Truth. I would like to bring up a much older film, and people don't often think about this, but think about Night of the Living Dead.
Oh my God.
I think I know where you're going with
that. That is absolutely correct. I just went right to it. That is an amazing one.
But think about it. The entire movie is about I think Ben is his name, and he's trying to convince everybody that's in the house, we gotta get out of here. The TV is saying that we have to like get to one of these shelters, so on and so forth. And meanwhile, I think it's like Mr.
Well, let's stop and actually give people, for the four people who haven't seen the movie,
a
recap. What Night of the Living Dead? What's the basic plot? Ben and Julie, was it? are
Barbara.
Barbara. How did I forget that?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I think maybe the actress was named Julie. But anyways, Ben and Barbara are in a house in the woods.
Yeah.
And zombies are everywhere, and they're trying to get in. And then more and more people sort of end up in this house, and they all have to survive the night.
Yes.
Basic zombie horror movie plot. The original.
Yeah.
So... All right,
but the thing about it is like there's a cellar in the house and it's pretty like well defended. And basically, one of the guys, I think his name is like Mr. Hooper, sort of says like, "No, we have to. Let's just go. We'll last the night out in the cellar until daylight." He just says, "No, we just stick in the cellar. We lock ourselves in. We'll be fine. We board up the house upstairs. It's gonna take them. They'll never get in."
Right.
And
he's into fortifications, yep. And he is painted as the villain in the film.
No, he is.
For that, for being too cowardly to come out and help, and I don't know other just things. He's wrong. He should not. We should not listen to this balding, foolish, middle-aged man who's
really just showing concern for his daughter that was attacked, or like you know before the film officially starts, and like they're just like trying to paint him as like this guy who's just stubborn and keeps telling people no, we have to stay here and so and so, and him being belligerent and so on and so forth. He won't do anything to help them, but like at the end of the movie when everyone's dead, everyone's killed off except Ben. What does Ben do? He goes down in the cellar and he lasts out the night. Like, he literally does what he fought against this other guy throughout the entire movie, who he kept saying, no, you're wrong, we'll never survive. He goes in the cellar and he makes it to daylight. Like, he literally makes it the next day.
That's absolutely right.
And it's just like, if you would just listen to him in the first place... Like, nobody would have died.
That's right. Mr. Hooper was absolutely right in this.
But at the same time, why couldn't half of them go to the basement and half of them go to the attic?
Any option could have been okay to have discussed.
Yeah.
But that movie definitely paints a picture. And the picture is that old guy is a angry, stupid coward that we should all loathe. He's actually killed.
Yeah.
He's actually shot and killed in that movie by human beings, and it's not The Walking Dead. So, like, that wasn't as common back then. And, yeah, sure, whatever. He did something to deserve it. Ben, but the point is that he absolutely was right. His methodology of surviving probably would have worked.
Yep.
They would have been locked in with a zombie. They would have been locked in with a little zombie girl.
Well, there was enough of them there, they probably could have taken her.
Yeah, certainly.
They had a gun.
Ben on his own took her out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a gun. It would have been, she would have gotten up, grabbed the trowel, and then be like, okay, this is done. And that would have been it.
Didn't she eat her mom?
She did, but that's because her mom was alone with her in the basement.
Right.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah. If everyone had gone down to the cellar, everyone would have been there for when this happened.
Maybe
been,
a few uncaring adults are like, I don't have any horse in this child's race.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, horse of the child, you know, like you don't care if the child lives or dies.
Yeah,
you
essentially.
You don't have a horse in that race?
Yeah,
you know,
I got you.
You know that?
I got it.
All right, James, go. You're first pick.
I said the cast of Firefly. They're also in Serenity, obviously, so that's a movie.
Right, yeah. All right,
well, I'll mention some of the things in the series here. I think the key conflict here is the plot point of Serenity. That definitely, I think, kind of brings this whole thing into context.
All right.
So in my version, the Alliance is actually, despite what people might think, a good, relatively good government body. And our big damn heroes, the Firefly crew, are really definitely not the good guys. Okay, so hear me out. In our introduction to Firefly... Mal kind of describes the Earth. The technical term he uses for the Earth no longer being habitable was, it is all used up. We've got Wash and his wife and the entire, I'll call them the mainline crew of the Serenity, all kind of come from this backwards outer rim reaches that fought this civil war against the Alliance, right?
Right.
So we're already under the frame of mind that they're maybe not so truthful of a narrator. Think about Kaylee. She has absolutely no official training working on the engine. She describes her her talent as basically her father telling her that she has natural talent. Now, take a look at the educated, quote-unquote, characters of the Firefly universe. Amara, Shepard, and Simon. Other than Simon, who has a particular beef with the Alliance because they, quote-unquote, did to his sister, Amara and Shepard have pretty much no beef with the Alliance. And think about that. Shepard doesn't have a beef with the Alliance, and his work takes him in and out of territory all the time.
Right.
That means that the Alliance, as far as a government ruling with an iron fist, has freedom of religion. Oh, and legal and monitored prostitution? Which is
that's something we can all get behind.
That's one of those things you see more
progressive societies.
Progressive yeah. societies portrayed as, right?
All right, all right. So I'll give you that the Alliance doesn't seem horrific on paper, but that still doesn't make our heroes good guys necessarily.
Well, I mean, think about the major plot point in Serenity, right? For those of you who don't remember or haven't seen the movie Serenity in a while, basically we have our cast of characters of the Firefly, which are kind of our lovable group of rogues, and they, in the midst of their adventure, discover a secret that the Alliance, which is their government body, had committed. In an attempt to terraform and start a new planet, they actually turned that planet's citizenry into these kind of like rage-filled monsters, and they kind of reproduced and then started terrorizing the outside fringes of the galaxy. So I guess their big moral dilemma is that they know the truth of some horrible secret for the government, and they believe everyone should know that. But the reality is, if people know that secret, it would throw the world into absolute chaos. I mean, they really have no idea or take into account the larger consequences of their actions. Their whole goal is to tell the truth for the sake of the truth. I mean, I guess, yeah, from a moral standpoint, that's good, but couldn't that also be construed as literally choosing to destroy society to throw chaos into the wind?
I don't know. They're anarchists. I don't know if that makes them bad guys necessarily. Matt, you were about to say something?
I was gonna say, like, their whole entire thing is to discover the truth. I mean, what the terrible secret was really terrible, and like keeping it hidden wasn't a very good thing. That was kind of like, I don't know, saying like Snowden shouldn't have released his information because that could have thrown the government into chaos.
Is that what you're saying, James?
That's not necessarily what I'm saying, but delicious. You have to take a look at these sorts of scenarios. Yes, well, you might be quote-unquote right in the area of Snowden. Julian Assange, when he released his information with WikiLeaks, got many U.S. troops killed. So there's no...
I'm not sure about that. I don't know if he got anyone killed. This is a little deep to get to the podcast.
All right. Just take it back for 1 second. Now, obviously, the sharing of sensitive data all willy-nilly with Mr. Universe was a bit irresponsible. But at the same time, the actions of the government body were also irresponsible. When they caused this horrible catastrophe, they packed up and walked away. They just washed their hands of it. The main characters of the show went back, and everything was exactly the way it was when they left. Like, the bodies were still in the same position they were when the catastrophe happened. And it was years ago. Years ago this happened. And we have literally crazed psychopaths caused by this event roaming the galaxy on the outer fringes. And, like, it's not a secret about where they are, and the government has done anything about them. They're letting them literally roam the galaxy, slaughtering people because they are mentally deranged by an experiment the government screwed up.
All right, two things that I will say. One thing is, I'm actually not convinced. I'm sort of on James's side here, but in certain aspects. I'm not entirely convinced that the government is the bad guy for trying what they did. Like, they tried an experiment. It failed. Experiments fail. And it's bad PR. They closed it off. Should they be honest about it? I would have agreed they probably should have, but as far as they didn't intend for things to happen this way, as far as like leaving, what were they gonna rescue exactly? A bunch of people that literally decided to stand and let themselves die? Like, there was nothing they were doing. That was it. That was the problem. Everyone was dying through like ennui. That was really what it was. And then there's the Reavers. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but space is infinite almost. You try hunting down things in space and tell me how difficult that is. you try eliminating an entire, like, essentially race that just showed up out of nowhere and extincting them when they live in space. Like, that's hard. How do you do that?
I'm saying this as if he's tried.
Right. Not only that. Honestly. No, but like, how...
You just try it.
How are you sure that the government doesn't take any actions against the Reavers or doesn't show up when a Reaver attack is present? We only know they don't show up because the Reavers attack when our cast is doing something illegal and therefore doesn't want to call the Alliance.
And that's what I was going to say. Believe it or not, the Reavers are only a threat to fringe space. These people that willfully choose to live outside the Alliance's laws.
This is so authoritative. It's so creepy.
So, and think about this. If you jump back to the show, think about this again and again and again. All of the villains, all of these people, they don't exist other than maybe the one assassin that comes from the government to kill her. Yeah.
And no, we get hints that Book may have been the same kind of assassin.
Well,
which is why the government doesn't bother him.
Well, other than one incident with one particular character in our cast, all the other threats to our cast are from external people in the Outer Rims who are abusing their own personal power. The mud farm guy, the band of like laser gangsters with the giant laser, the people stealing the medicine.
You know, if I hadn't seen the show, I would have thought you were making all of this up. All right, so
think about it.
I think James made his argument. I think it stands, and we got one. We got the Alliance, maybe not that bad after all, and our heroes, beyond being like lovable rogues, they are actually also like they're anarchists that don't care who gets hurt.
I'm just saying, submit to your government body. They know what's best for you.
Excellent.
Oh, God.
You are a terrible human being. I'm done.
All right, AJ, you're so good. You're on. What's your film?
We could talk about Walter Peck from Ghostbusters.
All right.
Who is a government savant. He's a government...
Savant?
Government official.
He's a government official. He works for the EPA, and he really thinks the Ghostbusters are just con men. And what does he want to do? He wants to show that they're con men because ghosts ain't real.
Right.
Like, that's all he wants to do. He thinks he's a good guy. He's doing his best to serve the state of New York and the city of New York City and stop these people from swindling all these people out of their money. And,
uh-huh.
and let's look at this. One of them is a con man.
They first of all, we have established that the Ghostbusters are not really that trustworthy. Many of them are not.
Yeah.
And what else is there? There's no real reason why Walter Peck should believe anything they have to say. Like, there's no evidence. He's not like the guy who's running that hotel and then he sees evidence of it everywhere.
Yeah.
So Walter Peck, at very least, is ignorant. But is he correct?
I will argue no, he's not. Well, because he's, for a few reasons, one of which is he's part of the EPA. And,
okay. Like, and clearly he must
be. No, I'm saying, the thing he accuses the Ghostbusters of doing is, like, they put on a laser light show. They're essentially frauds and so on and so forth, trying to get people believing into what's going on through some mass hysteria. Mm-hmm. But nothing that he's described goes under the Environmental Protection Agency. Nothing that they do is harmful to the environment.
Part of that, all right, that's interesting. Like,
I mean, you could argue the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would have a case because they're all, you know, walking around with unlicensed nuclear accelerators on their backs. But as far as the EPA goes,
hold on, you're wrong about this.
Hold on,
AJ's got a good point. Think about it, because. All right, so you're saying that he doesn't have jurisdiction because he's not like part of the like swindle bureaucracy. Like he's not. But if he believes that they're charlatans, that they're not actually doing what they say they're doing,
right.
And they're operating dangerous for the environment equipment in the attempt to create this stupid phenomenon, then AJ's right. Then he is doing his business.
But that doesn't mean that they has the that Peck essentially has the right to sort of stamp on our rights to just go ahead and prove that he is.
You don't have the right to just create nuclear weapons or even like... I mean,
unregulated nuclear proton packs.
But the thing is, Peck doesn't believe any of that is real by your own argument. Peck doesn't believe he's there walking around with nuclear weapons.
I'm not sure
like
that's
that.
Clear. I don't know if that's clear.
And what is their containment system in the basement actually containing? James, what are these forces that they're collecting from outside? These naturally occurring forces that they're concentrating in their basement. What happens when you turn it off? It exploded.
I feel like there's two arguments here. I want to hear what James has to say because he looks very annoyed. I don't know what this is. Is this more of us not kowtowing to government?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say, look, I'm learning a lot here on NobPro about trusting our government entities here. That's all I'm saying. Come to NobPro. Learn to trust your government. Just what I'm saying.
This is not the theme of this podcast. All right, so my argument is you can say that Walter Peck does not have the authority to do what he's doing if, in reality, he doesn't believe the Ghostbusters and also believes they're not operating any equipment that are doing any harm. In that case, he's really not doing his job as an EPA official, but there's no reason to believe that. They could be liars and also, like, selling poisons, you know what I mean? Like people who make vitamins.
When the Ghostbusters get arrested,
we're just gonna let me get away with that one, okay?
When the Ghostbusters get arrested, what were they doing? They were drilling a hole in the ground.
That's the sequel.
Yeah, it doesn't sequel. Matter.
Walter
Peck was in that movie.
Wait.
You're thinking of the second one.
Oh, no. Okay, they got arrested when he shut down the containment.
Yes, that's when they got arrested.
Let's go to the second one. I'm sorry. I'll jump movies.
But Peck's not in the second one. Right.
Yeah, you have to stick with the source material. I think that it's totally within the character of Walter Peck that he was not only thinking that they are liars and what they are literally doing, but that they are just like the crazy person who sells you like over-the-counter herbal medications. Like, you may not believe that's at all going to do any bit work. It's not going to help you in any way, but it also may hurt you.
The snake oil salesman.
When the snake oil is like mostly lead, like that's probably that might be what Walter Peck is thinking. This could be mostly
lead.
But
I definitely feel like the thing is, when Peck walks in, he's not interested in doing an investigation.
You don't know that.
No, he says it. Opening line of dialogue when he comes in there, he says like he's basing all of his opinions off what he's heard in the media. And I'm going to go ahead and say that I don't want any government official to come in and base their findings and their conclusions off what they just randomly heard
so
in a magazine.
So many libertarians on this podcast. It's ridiculous. Or socialists, I guess. It's going to be a fight.
The podcast and Atlas Shrugged.
God. All right, fine. Listen, let's talk about something that actually makes sense. The thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Which is history's greatest monster, Tom Hanks.
Oh, my.
Oh, Tom Hanks. So I think I can make a list of movies that Tom Hanks is actually the bad guy in.
Big?
There's a lot. I'm not going to list them all out because I want to focus on my favorite, which is the legendary film You've Got Mail. Now, I don't know if any of you have seen You've Got Mail recently or if you're very familiar with it, but the basic premise is it's the 90s, and Meg Ryan plays Kathleen Kelly, who is the operator of an independent bookstore, the shop around the corner, and she has an AOL screen name, Shopgirl, and starts up a friendly conversation / romance with another person played by Tom Hanks, who is actually Joe Fox, the owner and operator, or the like one of the many operators of a big book conglomerate.
Kind of like a Barnes & Noble stand-in.
Yeah, effectively Fox Books. And his screen name is NY152 because AOL chat room. This is legit, like hardcore 90s sci-fi. Anyways, they have like this online conversation and romance, but in real life they hate each other. There's such a rivalry. Oh my god. Now I feel like I understand why this is deemed a romantic classic. There's a lot of like there's a lot of letter writing to each other and the chance to like speak in long prose.
Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan.
Yeah, it's Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. You kind of get it. But in reality, Joe Fox, as played by Tom Hanks, is a sociopath. Anyone who would see him, if this movie were made today, people would be saying he's like a men's rights activist. He's like a gamer gator somehow. He's just this horrible person who just doesn't know when to stop. So here's a little recap of the film. It starts off with them, like, you know, chatting over the messages, and at one point, Tom Hanks brings his family, who are like these kids that are actually his aunt and uncle or whatever, some comical thing because his father remarries so often, into like a little bookstore to enjoy story hours, where he runs afoul of Kathleen Kelly. And they kind of like have it out, but it's not like it's not a major thing because she doesn't know who he is. He conceals his identity because she's complaining about Fox Books moving into the area, which will effectively somehow immediately run her out of business. I don't understand how that works necessarily, but fine. The existence of a bookstore nearby will immediately run you out of business. He conceals his identity in the very beginning, and it just gets worse. They're having their online conversation. At this point, nobody knows who each other are. And after a little while, they meet at like this book publisher convention where they just have at it. They hate each other. They start like a media war where, in her defense, Meg Ryan is throwing Tom Hanks under the bus, saying this big conglomerate, which is going to destroy my entire business, is in town. Please support your local vendor. Like, you get where her passion comes from. You don't quite get where his defensiveness comes from, but whatever. Still not too creepy. At one point, these two online agree to meet. Tom Hanks goes there a little earlier, looks through the window, and notices it's Meg Ryan and goes, oh, crap, this is that girl who's been giving me hell for the last few weeks, you know, by trying to defend her job and the livelihood of all her employees. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit here and let her wait in the cafe for what might be hours. It's unclear in the film. By herself, worried she's being stood up by a person she's starting to have feelings for, despite the fact that both of us are cheating on our significant others by agreeing to meet. So, cheater, conceals his name, lets her, like, just leaves her hanging for, like, hours. Then it gets worse. He goes into the cafe, pretends like, oh, wow, I was just here coincidentally, and he won't leave her alone. I counted it. She asked him point blank to leave at least three times. He sits at her table, makes fun of her for being alone, mocks her for being stood up, mocks every man that comes in the door, or like old ladies for some reason, and says, hey, is that your date? Huh? You queer? Is that what's going on? Like, he just ridicules her. I don't think he actually calls her queer, but he ridicules her for a long time. He manhandles her stuff like she brought a single rose to identify herself. He grabs the rose and he starts chewing on it like a complete creeper. She finally works up the nerve to say, you're a jerk. And feels very proud of herself that she could finally confront someone who's being a jerk to her. And he's like, well, all right, I'm gonna cry. My man tears, my man tears are manifesting. And he does the Tom Hanks, like, watery eye. And you're, like, supposed to feel bad for him? He's a jerk. He's a complete ass. He gets up and sits behind her. Like, he doesn't even leave. He kind of fake leaves. He's a stalker. He sits behind her, and when she takes out her mirror to make sure her eyes aren't watery because she just suffered all this abuse from Tom Hanks, he's leering at her in his compact mirror. If this were, you could find the clip online. Just search for "You've Got Mail" cafe scene, and people are referring to this as like a romantic scene. This is touching to them. It ain't touching. It's creepy as hell. He gets back on her table, like argues with her why you left, and then it keeps getting worse. So keep in mind, he knows who she is now. He leads her on with this chat conversation. He stalks her while she's sick. When she loses her business, he's the only person that shows up and gives her comfort, or one of the few people that shows up to give her comfort. He keeps maintaining in real life, as they slowly become real friends, because he just doesn't seem like he's really after her at all. He keeps mocking the person in the online conversation. Like, oh, he's probably a serial killer. Oh, he's probably a pervert. Oh, he's probably fat. That's the worst thing he could possibly be. Like, he's sock puppeting. There's words for this now. We have, like, words about people doing this on the internet. The one thing he didn't actually do is swat her. He didn't call a SWAT team into her apartment. Although I'm sure there's a deleted scene where he called it into her business before it shut down. He is a monster. Until eventually they mutually break up with their significant others, agree to meet, and he's like, I'm here. And she's like, well, I always wanted to be you. No, you didn't. This is Stockholm Syndrome. You're get out of there, Meg Ryan. Get out of there. Tom Hanks is history's greatest monster in this movie. And somebody agrees
because make a modern remake. Yes. Like have it like be like a psychological horror.
Oh, so easy. It would be so easy.
I feel like though we could go, and I don't want to like ruin your argument here by mitigating it to everything
states
else.
States' rights issue.
But I'm just saying he had every right. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. If you try to take too hard a look at a lot of romantic comedies,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're
all pretty awful.
Really bad.
Yeah, they
especially if you just like
Love Actually?
Marathon.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, Love Actually especially. Wow. Yeah.
If you're on the Lifetime channel, you're not going to see a whole lot of admirable men.
More women period. For that matter.
More women.
But that's not
Yeah, no, don't put words in his
applicable
mouth.
Applicable at all.
He's a meninist.
So I'll agree with me.
Say, well, meninist. Libertarian socialist meninist. That's a new podcast. God, this is awful. Matt, do you have anything to save us? Do you have a story that you would like to share with us about a film that the protagonist and antagonist may not be what we think they are?
I think it's more on the realm of there's the bad guy and then there's the worst guy, but it took me a while to see it, but I finally watched John Wick recently. Yeah, Keanu Reeves' character, like John Wick, he is definitely a bad guy. He's facing a bunch of worse people, but he's definitely a bad guy.
He's not. It's not that he's not an anti-hero. He's clearly a villain.
Give us the broad strokes of the film, because I haven't seen it.
So basically, at the beginning of the film, you find out that John Wick's wife died due to sickness. Oh. And the last thing she left for him, like, to help him move on, was a dog. So it has the beginning is like John Wick and the dog living together. Then this gangster's kid, and like kind of like this drunken stupor, decides to rob his house, not realizing John Wick was this like famous assassin that worked for his father, and steals his car and kills his dog. So the rest of the movie afterwards is John Wick on like some kind of blood-fueled rampage of revenge to kill the kid, his father, and everybody associated with them to get revenge for the dog.
That is clearly a villain.
Yeah.
That is not an anti-hero. That is not like a scruffy kind of guy.
No, that's the bad guy.
That is the bad guy in that film. He may be one of many bad guys in that film, but definitely not the hero. Wow. Yep.
I mean, like, I think the last scene, like, right when he actually catches up to the kid, like, he, like, in, like, bar- like gravely injures him, and like, but, like, leaves him, like, lingering alive. And, like, the kid goes, it was just a dog, and, like, but he can't finish dog, because, like, then he, like, John Wick just shoots him in the head.
It was just a dog!
Wow.
And even after all of that done, he decides, okay, now I need to kill the father. Because the father, I don't know, I guess,
protected
like, raised the kid
son.
And tried to protect him. Tried to protect his son. So clearly he needs to die as well. And then he goes to kill the father. It's, yeah. Nobody was really good in that movie. Nobody.
That is unfortunate. Like, all right. Well,
oh, my God.
All right. Good example. All right. We're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do a couple more rapid-fire ones for you. If you have any suggestions, go back in time and suggest it to us before we did this podcast, because that's the way time works.
Yes, it is.
Mm.
Behind the scenes of the filming of The Revenant, take one.
I have your sandwich, Mr. DiCaprio.
Oh, I'm Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh, man, I'm so hungry. Thank you.
No, you don't. Somebody slapped that out of his hand. There, God. Leo, we are filming The Revenant. It is your movie.
Sir, I haven't eaten in a week.
You've done a wonderful job with your starvation diet. Everyone applaud Leonardo DiCaprio for this wonderful job of this not eating. We want to win the Academy Award this
gonna
time.
Gonna win it this year. It's your year.
It's your year, they say. You say it too.
Yes, yes. Yes. I know, but you're letting Tom Hardy eat.
Tom Hardy is he chubby boy. He's a very chubby boy. He's fine, but we want you to get Oscar. Yes, you get the Oscar.
I mean,
this
Matt
time.
Damon didn't eat for like weeks in The Martian, right?
It's true.
What wasn't it's that CG? True. He was on Mars.
There's no CG.
You think Matt Damon used CG?
No, CG. We put him on Mars. That's real. He gonna win the Oscar unless you do it. I don't know. You listen to me. This is very special. This scene, you're going to win the Oscar for this scene alone. You're going to fight Bear. Wrangler. Bring Bear in.
Hang on. Fight a bear? That, you know, I want to win the Oscar. I do, but this doesn't sound safe.
No, don't worry. It's a trained bear.
Trained?
Yeah, got it from Russia. Winner of 2 championship wrestling matches.
He's very vicious bear. He's very trained well to kill. Oh. We're going to kill in the Academy Award nominations.
Oh, okay. Okay. You know, I'm not very strong right now because I haven't eaten for a week.
Yes, so yes. Very realistic.
Use it. Use that hunger. Eat the bear. Eat the bear.
Bite the bear.
Yeah, he's going to eat the bear.
Yes, you take a bite from the bear.
Okay, I guess we're going to do this then. All right.
We bring the bear in. This. Did you electrocute the bear? Just get him really angry. Just mess with him.
Oh, of course.
You make fun of his mother in English and Russian, just in case.
Yeah, no problem.
We got this. Leo, you remember, if you lose a hand or an eye, they got to give it to you. Well, I'm just saying.
But I'd like to attend the Oscars with my hand so I can hold the Oscar. We all like a lot of things,
but you're not going to get what you like with the Shutter Island. You got to go do it. You got to bring it. You got to bring it to the bear. Make love to the bear. All right, bring in the bear. He's ready. Leo's ready. It's going to happen.
Don't I get like a weapon or?
No. This is how it went in the story. You didn't have anything. Bare hands. Go ahead. Go.
Put some spray, some meat sauce on him. Leo,
here. Hold this him steak.
Down. Yes, okay. You're good.
Oh. Oh, God. Oh, God. Here he comes. Ow. God, please.
It's okay. It's okay.
Yo. Oh, please.
Leo, hold up your hands. Oscars don't go to losers.
No, don't.
Make yourself look small and edible.
Oh, my God. It hurts so bad.
Was I supposed to sedate the bear?
No. You don't sedate the bear.
Oh, my God. My eye.
That's it.
I think he's calmed down. Oh, no. He's back.
Oh, God.
He's back at the anger. Oh, this is not a good look for you.
Just keep thinking about your Oscar, Leo. It's going to be thinking good. About your Oscar.
Yes. You're fine. No.
It'll grow back. It's fine. It's a bear insured.
Yeah.
All right, we're back. AJ, you've got a rapid fire list of authority figures you'd like to share with us.
All right. I'll go down real quick. All right. So in Short Circuit, we've got Captain Skroker,
right,
who is literally the security officer in charge of getting the robot back.
Who basically in the film tries to get the robot back.
It's a killing machine that's gone on the loose, and he's trying to get it back.
Right.
That's all he wants to do, and that's all he does.
Right.
You know, he doesn't take sweet satisfaction in destroying the loved ones of... He just wants to get the robot back.
At most, some of these people are just kind of rude. All right, next.
There's Principal Ed Rooney, who...
From Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
He knows the kid's playing hooky. He wants to catch him.
He
wants to bring him back to school.
He's absolutely
this
right.
This kid needs an education.
Yes, that is literally his job.
That is literally his job.
To do this.
And then there's Dean Vernon Wormer. In Animal House. He's the dean. Obviously, the frat has gone out of control.
Yeah.
They have terrible parties. They destroy, they steal, they cheat on their tests. They're also, none of them are doing well in school.
Right. Yeah. No, that's
and
this is his job.
This frat is disrupting the campus and the lives of the people in it, and it needs to stop.
Yeah. Imagine being in Animal House when you're not in that cool frat.
They're in such trouble that he can't even publicly put them on probation.
Yeah.
Because if the public knew what they did, he would be in trouble for allowing it to happen. That's why it's double secret probation. No one can know that they actually did these things.
All right, James.
All right, so I have the first poster prints here. It says non-pro trust authority. We're going to hang these all around the office. I think that's what I'm getting here.
I don't know if you could say that fairly, James, because... I think Al is pretty much the, I don't think you have the strict authority to try to protect life, EPA guy. So we're still, the jury's still out on that one. All right, James, you do actually have another great one you'd like to share?
I do. I'm kind of jumping back into the Whedon thing. All so right. Josh Whedon wrote The Cabin in the Woods, and this might be more of an intentional misdirect, but I guess we kind of start out with the typical, again, horror movie vibe, as we've talked about before, and we're following these kids and horrible things are happening to them. And then it seems even more horrible when we realize that, like, two guys...
This is orchestrated.
Part of this orchestrated...
clinical, like it's...
Yeah, like suit and tie, check into work, check out of work, hit your time card, sort of clinical, evil, you know, sort of mastermind to sacrifice children to an evil god, right?
Right.
Well, as the movie continues to go on, we realize that the success of these kids evading this horrible organization that intends to murder them to an evil god literally will destroy the world.
Right.
And I'm just saying, in this case, it really is a case of the greater good. This organization, the people who do this, you know what? They do it. They may not like their job, but they got to find some satisfaction in it, and they got to do it, because literally otherwise giant demons will rise from the earth and cause it into a hellfire for the rest of eternity.
I think we've all been there.
That's I think, the best reason of any to do something
to kill
horrible.
Children.
Teenagers. Horny teenagers.
Justified it. All right, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think definitely the intent of the author is to throw a little bit of that, but I don't think you're supposed to leave the movie thinking that the organization was right necessarily.
I don't understand, because at the end, the organization loses and everyone dies. So, I mean,
you know what? This is a lesson that you should be humble in your work. If you weren't so smug about, like, what's on the whiteboard and let's bet on what's coming up, I think people would be more sympathetic to you.
In a weird way, yeah, probably.
Right there. Yeah. All right. Next on our list is, actually, let's go with AJ's suggestion.
All right. We could also go to the movie The Rock. In The Rock, a general in the Marines has taken over the tourist attraction Alcatraz. And he's locked all the tourists in the cells at Alcatraz. They've taken biological weapons, pointed them at San Francisco, and told the government that they want them to pay veterans benefits.
Well, oh, wait.
Yeah.
What's that? Yeah, wait.
We always breeze over this last part, but what he's really asking for is veterans benefits.
All right. Now, I wouldn't recommend... I don't agree with his
methodology.
Yeah,
but clearly clearly the bureaucracy failed him, and he thought it would be time to take matters into his own hands.
I think at very least he needs mental health benefit. Yeah, all right.
You know,
this
yeah,
is
you
not...
know what? He might also be a little messed up from his time in Desert Storm, as are most of the people in his command, which is why he's causing this military action to demand that proper care be taken with his men who were exposed to biological weapons in Saudi Arabia. And
this is dark. Oh, that's awful.
Help.
So our heroes in that film are trying to stop him from maybe blowing up San Francisco, killing prisoners, but also from getting benefits for their soldiers.
What happens is they just say, we don't negotiate with terrorists.
Okay.
And we're your terrorists.
So that begs the question, what if the terrorists ask for something that you would be willing to do? You're like, sorry, I can't do it anymore.
Like, veterans benefits?
Yeah. I want a cheeseburger.
No more cheeseburgers.
You don't want to
blow up every cheeseburger place.
You don't want to set the precedent that if you threaten to blow something up,
as a terrorist,
we'll give you what you want.
Benefits. You got to give everybody benefits.
Listen. If the terrorists were playing a good game of reverse psychology, they could ask for things they don't want to happen and be like, what are you going to do now?
I mean, this does land really close. In fact, this is actually what the author wanted, because during the movie, Sean Connery and Nick Cage actually go in to save him from his men, because his men realize, wait, we're not doing this for money.
Oh, interesting.
All right. We were doing this for money.
All right. I think that's a valid example. I like it a lot. Let's go with Al's. I think Al's is, so far, Al's been hitting it out of the park with two wonderful examples. This one is great.
Revenge of the Nerds. I'm just going to say it. Done. I know that this is in a weird way, this is this movie that was supposed to represent us, because we're all kind of nerds of one kind or another. But oh my God, could they not have gotten further away from anything that I thought represented me in any... These are slobs and terrible people.
I know, like, I've known some nerds like that. I know, but that's like not where my problem is.
Really, my problem with this is, like, the jocks make fun of them, so on and so forth, but this doesn't merit that all of a sudden that they get nude pictures of one of their girlfriends and then start selling it to the school. And
that is literally what villains do today in the real world. Yep. These are loathsome people. We do not acknowledge it, and these are our heroes.
Except they did it IRL, like with actual pictures.
With actual picture.
Isn't somebody in that movie wearing a mask and has sex with one of the jock's girlfriends?
With the exact same woman that he took pictures of. And
there is a sexual assault effectively in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently we as the audience supposed to think it's fine because like she learns all of these things about her. Because
she got her comeuppance for being mean to geeks.
No, not even that. Like she's fine with it in this film, apparently.
There's not a moment in the film where we're like horrified until we realize, no, she's okay with it. We're immediately supposed to accept it as acceptable.
Yeah.
And revenge of the nerds.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, there's a little bit extra acceptable because she seems to be okay with it. Apparently because the sex was good.
Which is not how it works. No, it's not.
That is not how it works, people. Yeah. This guy wins. This is the worst example.
My God.
They are just despicable human beings in this film. It's just awful.
So much so that we might actually have to finish up on this one. Because I don't think we could get worse than this.
This is really... Was this like a common problem with the 80s movies?
No, this was really just Revenge of the Nerds.
The thing about Revenge of the Nerds is it's supposed... Like, the fact that the nerd gets the girl is supposed to be the twist. You know? Like
It's a revenge fantasy film.
We're all supposed to hate the jock.
But not like the good Tarantino kind?
No.
Those
aren't even
it's that kind of depressed guy who wants what the jock has. And the fact that he gets it at the end of the movie, we're supposed to be like applauding. But
which I'm not like on the surface. I get why you would want something like this. You want a film where like the geeks had to come up. The geeks get what they deserve,
and the jocks get to come up. But
this is not the way of doing it. And to be honest, to answer your question, James, I think it's a little bit more prevalent in 80s movies than you would imagine. If you look into history, we were a lot more. And we may be, even now, a lot more comfortable with things that are just horrible. Think of how often in movies some bad guy getting assaulted, we'll say, in prison is considered fair. Like, oh, that's fun. That's great. That person is sexually assaulted for years now. That's horrible.
Yep.
But that was an amusing thing to happen in many a film. All right, who wants to go next?
What about the Jedi in the prequels?
Oh, all right. So you're suggesting that the Jedi... When we finally get to see what the real Jedi were like, they are actual bad guys.
Well, and I think this is maybe the, in my mind, the perfect example of this, right? Because I think the intent is for them still to be good. I mean, they're still trying to be purveyors of the peace, and they're still trying to end a war and do all these types of things. But really, they just end up becoming generals in this conflict, being manipulated into help putting real evil people in power. And they're just, I mean, they're just like, all the worst parts of like bureaucracy is like pushed into these Jedi that basically leave them doing like terrible things, right? Like, so all these governments and organizations we talked about, like in the rest of our things that were supposed to be good, the Jedi's that one organization and government that was supposed to be good, but it's not.
So you're pro-alliance and anti-Jedi council.
Yes, but I'm not pro-empire.
All right.
At least.
I don't understand.
He's pro-First Order. There's a difference.
apparently. We'll have to wait for the sequel to find out. All right. I guess that's fair. So it's really hard to like recap the prequels, but what do we learn about the Jedi? That they take children when they're very young, and they train them up in their methodology. They're not allowed to have emotions.
So they kidnap children to become monks, and then they try to remove emotion from people, right?
So none of that's good. They fight against trade unions.
Well,
that was under order from the government.
Literally,
which is pretty bad too.
I was going to say, they literally, an order from the government is to send armed killer knights trained as peacekeepers. And what is the first thing they do? They don't talk to people. I would like to point out that they slash the heck up out of that
door.
not just Dor, all the droids on that station, because well,
they,
there
weren't
are no
pumping
people.
That room. Yeah, they were pumping that full of poison gas.
I'm just saying, if you as a government, as you as the Jedi Order, want to, you know, show peaceful intent, probably don't send your highest general killing machines.
Yeah, everybody is armed with swords. Matt, you seem incensed about this.
Well, no,
stupid
I'm,
argument.
I'm not incensed at the things James brought up, because I do agree the Jedi are they're pretty big jerks in the prequels. But I'm going to say that this sort of doesn't fit, because I want to say all that stuff was intentional. Like, say what you will about Lucas's like direction and decisions, but like the guy knows like his allegories and his like meaning behind his messages. Like, keep in mind, this is the guy that literally did like a Viet Cong, like a pro Viet Cong like allegory with Return of the Jedi. Like, the whole entire Battle of Endor was pretty much Vietnam, but the good guys were the VC. I would give Lucas enough credit where he is fully aware that the Jedi have this horrible dogma, which leads, like, directly leads to their downfall, because Palpatine was able to manipulate it and use it to his advantage. And then going into the original trilogy, where the last remaining Jedi, Luke Skywalker, goes against the dogmatic teachings by showing love and compassion,
and he finds,
and thus
the
finally bringing the good end to the conflict.
So Matt is claiming author intent. All right.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'd give George that much credit for the two films he didn't write. But here's my key point. When Anakin Skywalker, as Hayden Christensen as Anakin Skywalker, turns to Obi-Wan and goes, "From my point of view, the Jedi are evil," you're telling me you're buying that? That whole scene right there. Because if you're not buying that scene, I'm telling you, I'm not buying the Jedi intentionally framed as the bad guys. I know Anakin sees it right there, but I think that's a lot of rush work to get to that point in the last.
I think, actually,
piece.
I don't know. I mean,
I think the follow-up...
Hold on, what happens? Is this during like the last fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the context of that line.
There's a follow-up line that actually says it pretty decently. Like, it's like, and Obi-Wan's response is like, "Only a Sith deals in absolutes." But I feel like that even goes more towards Matt's case, because that's George saying, wait a minute. Like, it was the absolutes that the Jedi even decided to go into, which was actually not a good thing. Like, it was all those moments where there was like, oh, if we just cut and dry it all, then it'll be fine. Uh-huh. It was that. I think that conversation does play into, like, Matt's theory of, like, this was author intent.
Can we talk about that line for a second? Only a Sith deals in absolutes. Which in itself is an absolute. And in fact, all the Jedi do is talk about absolutes.
Exactly.
My question is there a single hero in any of the prequel movies?
I
Jar Jar Binks.
No.
Maybe he was just trying to help. Maybe it was
Jar Jar probably had the most
noble
intentions in the whole entire movie.
Maybe
R2. Prequel trilogy.
Yeah. No, I don't trust R2.
But,
shady.
But I mean, trust going anyone on can't about talk. Going back to Obi-Wan, I mean, that isn't the first time where like he's completely blinded by like the Jedi dogmatic beliefs. I mean, the whole entire scene when he meets Dooku in Attack of the Clones after he's captured, Dooku literally lays out the Sith's plan in front of him. Doesn't lie at all. I mean, he does it in a tone that's very smug and superior, and like supposed to be manipulative, but Obi-Wan doesn't even consider it for a second that Dooku is telling the truth, because he's the bad guy.
Oh.
Like, yeah. Like if you rewatch that scene, Dooku literally says the Sith are using this whole entire conflict to bring themselves back into power. So if you join me, maybe we could beat them together.
Imagine this scene.
Like, nah, you're one of them. Why am I supposed to believe you?
Would you imagine the scene with Matt's delivery where he's just calmly telling Obi-Wan, like, the Sith are using this as a way of manipulating you, and Obi-Wan's just like, nah, bro. You're full of it. All right. Well, this might actually be a case of author intent. We'll
I
let
think
the
I might
audience
need to go
decide.
Rewatch the prequels, and
do
I literally
not do
just
that.
Watch them.
Do not do that. That's why. I'm not throwing the prequels on the bus. I'm just saying, because you just did it, and it's on our YouTube channel. Rewatch your rewatching of it. All right. Enough about these independent art house films that no one has seen, like Empire and the prequels and the Jedi and whatever. I'm going to talk about a movie that we've all hold near and dear to our heart. And I'm going to talk about Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, which I believe is the first one. Is that
yes.
right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
The good one.
Oh, my yeah. God.
So just want to just point this out. This is very similar to what we're talking about. And I think, you know, we've got a little bit of the heroes are idiots, if not bad guys. And the bad guys are right in a way. The object of this film, what the point of the movie is our heroes are trying to stop these undead, immortal, unstoppable villains from becoming vulnerable. That is the point of the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. It is absolutely the point. There, the Black Pearl, the undead pirates, want to get somebody's blood. I forgot his name. You know, from Legolas. What is his name?
Captain. Oh, they need Will's.
Will Turner.
Bootstrap Bill Turner's
blood. Yeah, they need his blood or the blood of one of his descendants of somebody on the ship, whatever, for whatever reason. And if they get his blood, they can perform this ritual, or they just need a drop of blood. And then the entire crew can go back to being mortal so they can taste things like apples. That is the point. Until that happens, they are unstoppable. They are the only really supernatural things that exist in the world at that point in the first movie. They are unstoppable. They're devastating the world with their evil pirate ways. And our heroes are desperate to stop this from happening, mostly because they're ill-informed. But still, that is the point of the movie. And that is so annoying. Once you realize it, it's like seeing a J.J. Abrams lens flare and you just can't stop seeing it.
Yep.
James, you're going to tell me I'm wrong.
No, wait. Isn't the point
it's about states' rights.
Well, no. Yes. No.
Actually.
So the point of the movie is they go after Will. You're right. To get the stuff back, right?
Get their
lives back.
Yes.
So... really, isn't it Will Turner goes after Kate Blanchett's character?
Yes. She's not in that movie.
Not Kate Blanchett.
Keira Knightley. Keira Knightley's character.
This was a blockbuster. We already forgot everything about it.
The other films are really bad, so...
I don't know about that. I like the second one.
Yeah, second first, one I love.
All right, continue.
First one's great. So, they go after Keira Knightley's character,
mm-hmm.
who is captured in place... of Will as pretending to be her descendant, right? So technically, isn't the main drive of the film to rescue her? You're right, though. If they rescue her, that means they can't become mortal. You're totally right.
Well, the thing is, like, if
they're misinformed, but that doesn't matter. They're just misinformed, which just does not make you feel any better about
this. Because when they find out at the end, they do the coin thing and then use that to kill...
Yeah, as soon as he becomes mortal, they're like, hey, here's a drop of blood. I mean, you could argue that they didn't know it was a drop of blood, that maybe they thought it was like you'd have to be sacrificed for it. I don't know. The pirates may have been willing to...
Well, they don't even tell you why they're kidnapping him or her at the beginning of the movie. You only find that out after she's on the ship.
I'm just saying that we should give the pirates what they want so we could beat them. So I think we have a wonderful set of examples where, again, without author intent... special readings of the film prove that our heroes are actually idiots at best, villains at worst, and our bad guys, maybe we should just give them what they want, and then it'll all be okay. And I think that's a great job. A round of applause from all of us. We basically fixed movies.
All right.
So, yeah, all right. Congratulations. If you'd like to hear more about this kind of stuff, you should probably subscribe to this podcast channel, because this is where we do it.
Yep.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Cuddly as a cactus, you're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black
bean. This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.